Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am, of course, Josh Placer, and we have a great cast for you tonight. For today's podcast, we're going to be talking about the recently released game, The Flame of the Flood. It was a Kickstarter project that succeeded, went to early access, and was following release. By the time you hear this podcast, it should be about maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And my guest tonight is the CEO/designer from the studio, Molasses Flood. So please welcome to the podcast, Forrest Dowling.
Hey.
Hey, Forrest, it's a pleasure to have you on tonight.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Josh.
Awesome. And before you get going, definitely congratulations on the release of the game. I know we said this before the cast, but it's always great to see a project get through, you know, the whole cycle between Kickstarter, early access to full release.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really proud of doing that. And I know that there can be a lot of cynicism out there about the whole, well, all this stuff, really, about Kickstarter, about early access. And everybody always sees, like, when stuff doesn't work, because that's the big story. That's the good story, right, is the big failure. But, I'm really glad to have sort of gone through all these sort of new processes that didn't exist a few years ago.
Yeah, and that I think will definitely be a major part we'll talk about tonight on the cast, but we've definitely seen a lot of interesting buzz and movement around both Kickstarter and Early Access. I know, as you were just saying, Forrest, a lot of people like the stories, you know, when a big project fails, whether it's on Early Access or Kickstarter, but we're seeing more and more developers jump at the chance of putting their games, or I'm sorry, starting out with like a concept and putting them on Kickstarter. And I've been speaking to a lot of developers lately. I spoke with Liam Welton from Fail Better and Tim Keenan from Misfits X, who both went Kickstarter and Early Access route, and they had like nothing but good things to say about both platforms in terms of being able to develop a game through them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can be very, very powerful for sure. I'm sure there's probably some people have very mixed views, I'm sure, as well, depending on how successful their particular project was. On one of those things. Who are those gentlemen you said Fail Better? They did Sunless Sea, correct?
Yes.
And I wasn't familiar with the other off the top of my head.
Tim Keeney from Misfits X, he is currently doing the game Duskers.
Duskers. Okay, cool. Yeah. I'm familiar with the name, but I don't. I wasn't familiar with their Kickstarter. But yeah, Sunless Sea, I think they actually went through a really similar Kickstarter and timeline. As us. I actually was looking at them as far as like early access to release, because I'm pretty sure they released in the summer in early access and then were in EA for like 6 months, 7 months or so, and released early in the following year.
Yeah. I'm not sure if Duskers did do Kickstarter, but I definitely know they are doing early access. But yeah, it's definitely interesting to see how these two have really models have really shifted game development, especially for independent developers. Now, I know with your background, which we'll be talking about next, you've worked at a AAA studio. You were part of Irrational Games for a time.
That's correct.
So, to get things going, before we go further, for people listening to the cast who may not know about you or your background, could you talk a little bit about yourself, especially your track through the game industry?
I'll give like the super quick version. It's sort of like 15 years of time, so we'll condense it. I guess I got into making mods and stuff when I was in college. It just fascinated me, and I ended up doing that sort of by night for 5 years or so after graduating, when sort of doing a job that was fine, but not really what I wanted to do. But yeah, I made like Unreal Tournament and Half-Life 2 mods and whatnot. And then I ended up getting hired by a studio called Chaos that was based out in New York at the time. And they were a bunch of ex-mod guys. They're sort of were put on the map by this mod they made called Desert Combat. So I got a job there as a level designer, and I worked on Homefront and Frontlines Fuel of War. I think more people probably remember Homefront than Frontlines. So I worked there for about 5 years and ended up going from like entry level designer to lead level designer, and then got picked up, poached basically by Irrational, and ended up being the lead level designer on BioShock Infinite. So I ended up leaving Chaos because, you know, I was a huge fan of BioShock and I couldn't say no to going to work on that. Mm-hmm. So then I worked at Irrational on Infinite through Ship and through all the DLC, and was there the day that it sort of, I guess, it closed, downsized, what have you. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I just teamed up with a bunch of people that I had worked with previously on Infinite, who were all sort of in town, and we were all out of work, and we were all looking for, you know, what was next, and we all, a group of us decided to work together and make a game on our own. And that was about 2 years ago at this point. And cut to today, that game is out. So yeah, that's been sort of my path, is basically art degree, level design, indie studio.
And we're hearing a lot more of these stories of developers going from the AAA market to being independent studios. And this is definitely the time to be doing it, as we've said with Early Access and Kickstarter. It's a lot easier these days to strike on your own compared to, you know, 15, 20 years ago, where you needed the backings of a big publisher and a massive studio to even put out, like, a small video game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is and it isn't the time, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's the tools are a lot easier, but that also means that, like, so exactly. many more people are doing it, and it's way more competitive, you know. Like, at any given day, the stuff that's profitable is what's sitting in, like, there's 10 slots on Steam, and that's really where money is being made. So, you know, it's the barriers to entry are a lot lower, but the competition is a lot fiercer now as well, amongst everybody, really.
Yeah.
Like indies and big AAA, like we're all vying for the same sort of screen space and people's time and dollars. So So it's easier but tougher at the same time. Like, it's easier to make a game, but it's a lot harder to get noticed once you do.
Yeah, and the discussion about just how challenging it is to make a game, that is something that we could easily spend a good hour, 2 hours on at minimum, especially with, as you're just saying, Forrest, how much it has changed over the last 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that you mention Irrational Games, Forrest, because during our first year doing these podcasts on Game Wisdom, we actually spoke with another former Irrational Games developer, Joe McDonough, who went on to work at Blue Manchu for a while and did the game Card Hunter, or helped design it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to be able to talk with all these former guys from Irrational Games. That was one of my favorite studios growing up. During that cast, we had, like, nothing but praise to say about the Freedom Force series. And talking about, like, BioShock Infinite, that was another just major standout game from the studio.
Yeah, it's had a pretty distinguished history. And also, I think, you know, it's pretty remarkable the number of different studios and projects and stuff that have spun out of even just like the BioShock series. Like, you've got stuff like Gone Home. Let's see, The Novelist. Wow, man. I made a list the other day, and now I'm like completely blanking on a bunch of them, but the number of people who've worked on, let's see, Neon Struct, Eldritch, God, there's so many. I'm totally blanking on them, but yeah, it's certainly a studio that spirals out a lot of people that end up doing their own thing.
One of them, like, this is just a quick tangent, but I have to say it. One of the things I really found fascinating about Irrational Games is that it was really one of, like, the first major studios to really grow into its own brand. Like, the Irrational Games brand was very recognized for like pretty much like the last 20 years. Like, other studios, like, it definitely reached that point, like other studios such as Valve and Blizzard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in terms of, you hear that name of the studio and you get excited about it. And bringing that back and talking about indie development, that's one of the things that we're seeing with a lot of indie developers these days, with basically building their studio as a brand. Mm-hmm. So you have studios like Clay Entertainment with the Don't Starve series, Invisible Inc. I spoke with the guys from Red Hook Games, who, of course, not only followed a similar track as Molasses Flood, they did, you know, the Kickstarter to Early Access, and they're also all about building that brand up. Mm-hmm. And as you were saying a few minutes ago, Forrest, with how on one hand, it's easy to get into the industry, but hard to make a name for yourself. Mm-hmm. That brand building, I think, is becoming more and more of a critical factor for developers trying to break in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's definitely true. And I think that there's a lot of things about sort of big AAA development that are kind of seeping into indie development. And a lot of those things are related to things like marketing. And, yeah. And for sure, like brand recognition, be it like the gross, you know, personal brand of, you know, this developer, you know their name, mm-hmm. And you'll follow them, versus like a collection of people in a studio, and you know their work and you'll trust them. Like, you basically, it makes sense that people will look for anything that can sort of help them sift through all the various options that are in front of them. And I think that, like, knowing that a studio or a person has done good work in the past, or even just that you recognize the name, I think makes a huge difference when somebody's like looking at Steam and trying to figure out, like, oh, do I want to even give this the time or not? You know?
And that's also going true for like YouTubers and Let's Players these days. There's another part I get to date myself too with. I remember a time before the whole YouTube craze where there's no such thing as Let's Plays, videos, Twitch streams, a whole deal. Mm-hmm. But that's also become a major part, not only of game development, but of marketing. You see guys, you know, becoming recognizable faces on YouTube and also being able to almost help a game out just by mentioning it on their feed or playing a video. It's one of the things that I've been trying to grow with Game Wisdom with, like, the last 7 months with doing regular streams and videos as well, which, for those of you listening to the cast right now, I put up several videos on the Flame of the Flood on the YouTube channel, some beginner videos and a spotlight. I'm still thinking about maybe doing some more if people are interested in it, but it's really become, again, like, this whole other market to the game industry.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I recently did some traveling and to do press for the game, and I was, in addition to meeting with sort of traditional press and journalists, you know, I had, you know, a guy who just does YouTube and Twitch streaming was on my meeting circuit, mm-hmm. for sure. Like, it's definitely changed, and I mean, I think that that's also relates to the density of stuff out there, and you just, if you're developing a game, you want to reach people in as many ways as possible. Yeah. And, you know, I think that, YouTubers and streamers are really, they have audiences that love them, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're just crazy how huge they are, mm-hmm. as well in their reach. So yeah, it's like an interesting new kind of form and a new thing, and a thing that, also, I'm definitely old. Like, this was not a thing that was around when I was growing up or yes. learning to make games. Like, at that time, online video was basically like these chunky mm-hmm. real player videos that would run at 5 frames a second and have tons of compression as you mm-hmm. slowly wait for things to stream in over some struggling DSL line.
Yes. And I bet we could reminisce about the last 20 years for a whole part of this cast. But there is one question I do want to ask you about, Forrest, and this is one thing that I ask a lot of developers who have come on, who have made the move from AAA to indie. I think I know part of what your answer is going to be, but as someone who has made that switch, are there any, like, major or noticeable differences between working as a AAA studio versus an indie studio that you could share with the people listening to the cast?
I mean, I think the biggest and most obvious one is just scale. You know, like, communication's a lot easier and a lot quicker when you're only, you know, talking between, like, 6 people.
Yeah.
So there's, like, a lot less need for sort of infrastructure to facilitate things, like just tracking conversations and meetings and that sort of thing. But also, you know, resources are way more limited, so you need to, mm-hmm. but ultimately it doesn't end up being that different. Like, when you're working in AAA, you still, no matter how much you have, like how many resources you have at your disposal, there's still limits to what can be done. You know, like, there's mm-hmm. still, well, is there going to be enough time to do this? Is there going to be enough people to execute on this idea? Because there's so much more that tends to be happening in a project. So those same discussions and decisions need to be made on a small team, But you just need to make them, like, the constraints just are more constrained, I suppose, when you're working on a small team. Yeah, and I guess also you just feel, like, a little more just out on your own on a small team, you know? Like, you don't have sort of armies of various support people around you, you know, be it, like, business people dealing with, like, contracts with outsourcers or production people dealing with, like, you know, how much money is being spent or, you know, what the schedule looks like, or PR people dealing with, like, with the public. You just need to sort of do all that stuff yourself and end up feeling, like, way more exposed. You know, there's good and bad to that, of course. Like, it's certainly empowering and exhilarating to sort of to be responsible for everything and to sort of have all that in front of you and have complete visibility into everything that's going on. But at the same time, it's kind of scary.
Yes. I've heard that a whole lot from a lot of developers coming on. And the same thing as the positive. It is very liberating to be able to essentially do what you want. You don't have to answer to a publisher. You don't need to, you know, worry about outside forces affecting your game. You're just making with you and the rest of your team. And the intimacy of having that small team versus, you know, a 70, 80 man studio.
Yeah. And I mean, and ultimately, like, the consequences of doing poorly in either situation are about the same.
Yeah.
You know, like, I worked at Irrational and at the end ended up out of a job, and now I'm working for myself. And if it doesn't go well in the end, I'm out of a job. So the stakes are about the same. But yeah. Now I get to sort of at least call my own shots along the way, which is really nice. And it's much more, you know, like, my own responsibility too.
Yeah.
Which is great.
All right. So let's move on and talk more about the Flame of the Flood. And I think the best place to start would be the Kickstarter and the early concepts for the game. So, before the cast, I was looking at your Kickstarter campaign for it, and I guess my first question then for you, Forrest, and this is one I like to ask all of our developers who come on, did the Flame of the Flood's original concept sort of start with the intent to go to Kickstarter, or did the Kickstarter idea come up during development of it?
Well, we basically needed money relatively fast one way or another, and Kickstarter was certainly one thing that we were looking at. We also did end up talking with some publishers as well, but we were early enough on where we had, you know, a concept and we knew what we wanted to do, but the kind of the team size, the team wasn't proven, so that's already a tough sell for a publisher in that, you know, we just formed, and all they knew is, you know, we worked for a big studio previously, but that doesn't really mean anything because we could have been the clowns. and also, you know, it was early enough on that, and we needed a small enough amount of money that really, if you're asking for, like, these smaller sums from publishers, they kind of want the game to be, you know, pretty done and pretty proven at that point. But it was, we were going to need something before it was really, before we had time to really build a great prototype. So that's how we ended up going to Kickstarter. And additionally, it seemed like the amount that we needed, like, we thought that the project was going to do pretty well on Kickstarter. And we figured, well, we could, you know, take publisher money and in the end, own a lot less of the game, you know, when it's actually out and selling. Or we could go to Kickstarter and just take it to the people who want the game directly and end up not, like, sort of trading our ownership of it, which would theoretically put us in a better position down the line to actually, you know, grow the studio and make another game and whatnot. Because, you know, the more you can keep from everything you make, the more that you can then reinvest in making more stuff in the future.
Yeah.
So that's sort of how we ended up going the Kickstarter route, you know, it was after talking to publishers and whatnot and realizing, like, that wasn't going to work for us for a bunch of reasons. And I think we were really fortunate to have been able to get something on Kickstarter pretty quickly and have it resonate with people and actually have it, like, work, which is great. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where did the design idea for the Flame of Flood come from?
So there's like, I suppose not just one spot, but like some of the earliest ideas for it started. Like, there was, from a design standpoint, I wanted to explore the idea of just doing a survival game that was about sort of pure survival stuff, not any of the sort of more fantastical or supernatural stuff, like more more Bear Grylls than Walking Dead. or less Stroud, I would rather reference than Bear Grylls.
Nice.
Less is definitely the one I prefer.
Thank you.
Way more legit. That sort of came about from just actually playing DayZ. But I was playing at a time where there was like some bug where I don't remember if it was that zombies weren't spawning or they didn't see you. So they would be walking around, but they would never attack. And it was the first time I was playing it, and my experience was basically just wandering this world and rummaging around houses and finding, you know, shoes and better bag and cans of beans and that kind of stuff. And I just sort of had fun with that experience of just kind of hunting around for stuff and finding stuff and exploring this world. And I just got thinking about the idea of doing more of like a pared down survival game, like take what we're seeing with other survival games and just sort of delete a bunch of the more wacky elements from it and see if, like, I could just, working in that smaller space of just, you know, just survival, just wilderness survival, you know, could I make something interesting there? So I guess it kind of started from, like, that thought experiment. And then that combined with working with art director Scott Sinclair, he really liked this idea of tiny worlds, you know, like just little spaces that you explore with this little character. So like those two ideas kind of combined, and out of that came the river, and from the river came sort of the setting in the American South, and from that came the music, and then these things sort of combined and got iterated on, and that's where the look came from.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was, I guess, probably just playing a broken version of DayZ was where sort of some of the initial inspiration came from. And then, you know, after that, once the initial ideas are there, inspiration came from all sorts of different sources, ranging from like survival books to, you know, various documentaries and films and sort of all over the place.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up the art aesthetic, because I definitely want to talk more about that layer in the cast, because it is a fantastic looking game. I'm always a sucker for games that really have a unified aesthetic and design. Mm-hmm. Games like The Flame of the Flood, Don't Starve, or even games that you can just get that sense that everything clicks together. Like another older example would be something like Shadow of the Colossus, with how the look, the feel, and the music all work in that sense. Now, one question that has been bugging me that I really want to ask you about, Forrest, because this is a stupid question, but does the title The Flame of the Flood, does that represent anything? Because it's been driving me nuts. So I was feeling it should, but I just couldn't think of anything off the top of my head.
I mean, it's just sort of a loose metaphor for the player in the world.
Okay.
Like, she is the flame. She's carrying the flame, you know. Mm-hmm. But nothing more specific than that.
Okay, that's good. I thought, because I was racking my brain for like the last week going, this sounds like I should know what this is, but I just couldn't think of anything.
Yeah, it's not really a reference to anything in particular. It was just, I thought it sort of, well, one, it was available. Like, just finding names is really hard that aren't already trademarked and whatnot. So it had that going for it. But also, like, we just sort of really liked the poetry of it, and the imagery of it seemed to fit like a lot of some of the very early art that featured just sort of campfires in these sort of cool blue nighttime worlds surrounded by water. It evoked the images that we wanted.
Yeah. Now, another question that I have for you regarding Kickstarter, Forrest, this is another one that I like to ask all the developers we have on. As someone who went from AAA to the indie studio and then to Kickstarter for your first time, How did you approach developing the project, figuring out, you know, how you want to pitch this game, what are you going to offer as goals, stuff like that? Because this is another one of those topics that we see a lot of developers who are trying to make it on their own as well, they can sometimes stumble with in any one of these different parts.
Yeah, I mean, so, geez, like setting up the Kickstarter, we talked with a lot of friends that had, you know, run Kickstarters before, or people that were maybe experienced with like marketing and messaging. We did a lot of research, you know, like just I went through, I mean, I'm kind of like obsessively data driven at times. Like I went through a lot of successful Kickstarters and even just like did word counts on how long their campaigns were. to figure out like sort of oh, what's a really short one and what's a really long one and what's around the average. I think the average is around 1400 words. You know, it just sort of looked at like a lot of the information that people shared, a lot of different tiers and, you know, what people offered. And we just did a lot of research into sort of figuring out like what would be compelling, what's worked, what hasn't worked, and just tried to use as much historical data as we could. I also, you know, if anybody's listening that is sort of trying to figure out like the messaging side of things, like what do you write? Like what do you actually put in your campaign? One of the people, actually a couple of people that helped us with a lot of our messaging, you know, like a lot of how, you know, we write about the game, run a website now called indiedevkit.com. They're extremely experienced, like marketing and PR people, who, you know, I worked with one of them, Leonie Manchandon, on BioShock Infinite, and now she's working just helping indies, and they have like a ton of guides and stuff. And we did some of the exercises that are on their site before they had a site. You know, some of the exercises they do for coming up with like the language and whatnot of how you talk about a game, but they have like some great guides too. With you know, so I think actually I'm in their Kickstarter guide with some like quotes and stuff, as I recall. But yeah, for us, like just leading up to it was just research, and just trying to figure out like, okay, what works, what doesn't, and what's smart and what isn't, and you know, who's, how people burn themselves, because like a lot of people burn themselves with things like physical goods, you know, like they can be really difficult and expensive to produce. So like I figured out like, all right, here's how we're going to ship them. Here's the size of the boxes that we're going to need. Here's what the cost is going to be everywhere in the world. And I think that's actually improved, because when we did the Kickstarter, you needed to basically have a one price fits all international shipping. So like if we really took off in Germany, you know, but didn't, like nobody paid for international shipping in Canada because like Canadians just didn't like the game or the idea, we'd end up like losing money or miscalculating. Whereas now I'm pretty sure Kickstarter allows you to do like per region international shipping. Sorry, this is like super boring stuff, like looking up international shipping fees and making sure that like, oh, for this size box and this weight with a poster, a t-shirt, a book, is going to cost this much to ship to these territories, and here's what the averages are going to be. There's a lot of spreadsheets, basically, leading into a Kickstarter with a lot of, you know, different fields and variables where you could plug in like, well, let's assume this distribution of pledges internationally and so on and so forth.
Yeah. A few weeks ago, I spoke with Anthony Conta from, what was it? Oh my God. My brain is scrambled. I can't think of all the names of these teams. I've spoken to too many developers, I think that's the problem.
Yeah.
But we did a whole cast on talking about these kinds of issues with physical goods, understanding the shipping side, fulfillment. And it really is challenging to do that as not only as a developer, oh, here's the name, Urban Island Games. That's who I was talking to. But it is something that, as you're saying, Forrest, there's a lot of ways to burn yourself when you're going the Kickstarter early access route. And it is important to do the research and understand those risks.
Yeah.
And like speaking to developers like yourself, the ones who have succeeded were the ones who look at from every angle and understand the pros and the cons before making their Kickstarter. Because we've seen examples of developers who either rush on the platform or don't necessarily plan out their reward structure, and it will burn them during development or worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think you just need to be cautious and assume the worst case scenario, like for everything. I mean, same with early access. Like, I'm sure that there's projects that are never leaving early access because they ran out of money, and that's because they counted on early access to make them more money and didn't assume the worst case scenario, which is that it wouldn't.
But with that said, I think that would be a good springboard into talking more about early access, and then we will wrap up with talking a little bit more in depth about the Flame in the Floods gameplay and the design of it.
Sure.
So, moving on to the early access side of things, when did you guys decide to go on to early access with the Flame in the Flood?
That's a good question. We knew we needed to have a backer beta because that was part of our Kickstarter. So we knew that we were going to get the game into backer hands initially. And I don't recall. I think we actually did, like, we let people pre-order it right after the Kickstarter with the promise that they would get it once it was in early access. So I think we were kind of committed fairly early on to doing that route. I'm trying to remember. I mean, we did debate it almost like right up till we were in early access. We were kind of like, maybe we should just do the backer beta until we're ready to launch. But we did ultimately, obviously, decide to go into early access, in part just because we wanted, like, we had sort of hit the point where we were getting much new feedback from our backer beta folks, like from our Kickstarter folks, because we sort of had tapped that pool of players, and just wanted, like, more feedback and more input on the game.
Yep, and that's what we're seeing a lot with early access and talking with, as I said earlier in the cast, Liam Welton and Tim Keenan about their early access experience and how much it can really help to improve the game as you get all these eyes and free testing on your game before, that the big 1.0 change.
Yeah, for sure. And we had a lot of really great feedback and a lot of really enthusiastic, helpful, players and people that were really active in the forums and whatnot. And it certainly made the game a lot better than it would have been if we had not gone through early access, for sure.
As another question for you, as a developer who went from AAA to indie, how did you, I guess, overall find early access, like coming into this environment as both, the first time for your studio and the first time as, developing a game in this form?
I mean, I thought it was certainly a very different experience, for sure. Like, it reminded me a lot of talking with people that work on, like mobile or Facebook games or something, in a way where the game, or MMOs, where the game is now like a live service, as opposed to, as opposed to something that you just sort of ship and forget. So yeah, I mean, that's very different. Like, on big AAA projects, there's always like this date, and you're always working towards this date, and you've got these like bug countdowns that are moving towards this date, and on this date it needs to be done and everything needs to happen and everything needs to fire. But then after that, there's like a patch, and there's a big scramble for that, maybe a second patch, but then it's kind of done, so there's like this huge sort of momentum leading up to this one point, but then there's this release and you're done and like, okay, take your vacation, it's fine. Whereas like early access, there's this like, big lead up to this release where everything needs to be good, but at the same time it's early access and like the audience can be kind of forgiving, so if there's like some rough edges here and there, it's okay, but everybody's going to want updates really regularly, so you've got this big push to release, and then you do like a hot fix or two, and then you've got a big push to release 3 or 4 weeks later, and so on and so forth. So you're sort of always moving on this like push to get like a new sort of releasable version of things out, which is just a very different feel. Like, it feels like a different sort of relentless than like the lead up to shipping a big title feels, I guess, if that makes sense.
And having like that transparency between of going early access versus like a traditional game development, I think it's another big moment for game developers making that jump. We've spoken to a number of developers on the cast here, whether those who first started with the indie route or have gone, you know, AAA to indie. And it's always fascinating to see, like, the difference of transparency now compared to, like, 10, 15 years ago. This goes, again, back to what we were talking about earlier in the cast with building your brand and, you know, being that face now compared to earlier. But especially with early access and with Kickstarter, it's very fascinating to see just how much game developers are now, like, pretty much laying it out there for people to see and consume, and more importantly, with early access, to give feedback on.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's actually a really great thing overall. Mm-hmm. Like, I think a lot of transparency stuff doesn't exist in big AAAs.
Yes.
Because there's, like, these really, really precise sort of marketing plans that are always flying around, and there's always secrets, and there's always, you know, like, this needs to be revealed at this moment, and it can't be revealed before because this outlet has this information and they've got a 24-hour exclusive with it, and because of that they're going to put it on the front page, which is going to get this many more views, so that's why it's really important that, like, nobody says this thing or that thing, and, like, every piece of information about the game is like this little bullet in the chamber of that can be fired into the marketing apparatus, you know, and yeah, and bargained, and it all has, like, value, right? Because a game site wants to have the thing that nobody else has, so it gets the clicks, and that's, you know, that's what powers them. So there's all this, like, so that's, like, one side of it. And then there's always these really complicated kind of relationships between who knows, like, how many different partners and whatnot. And you never want to risk or jeopardize that by just allowing one of the 100 or 200 people that are working on a project to just kind of publicly kind of say whatever about it. Because that can lead to all sorts of different problems, and I totally understand why it needs to be that way and whatnot. But it is something that I really like about sort of being smaller and indie and whatnot. I'd love to actually share more, but, you know, part of working with Valve and Microsoft and whatnot means that, like, I have to sign NDAs with, you know, just about everybody that we work with, to one degree or another, and they're not nearly as restrictive as, like, the kind of clamp down on things you can say working for, you know, when you're essentially like a line developer on a huge project, but there's still, like, there's a lot that I can't say very specifically, see, about, you know, one thing or another, that would be nice to share. At the very least, I try and be as transparent as possible with folks, and, like, with our Kickstarter backers, and there's some stuff, like, I know our Kickstarter backers, we kickstarted Mac and PC, but missed all our console stretch goals and did end up going on to the Xbox, and people wanted, you know, Xbox keys, but it just was something that we looked into and are just not going to be able to do, and unfortunately, like, the details of why are things that I can't actually talk about, and it would be much simpler if I could, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's just a lot less of that frustration. I get to be, like, way more public about things. Although it is funny, like, I've worked for big companies for so long. Like, before I was in games, I worked for Apple, and it was kind of a standing order that if you posted anything about Apple on social media while working at Apple, you'd be fired. So I got pretty used to just, like, not expressing, like, any controversial opinions in any public environment for a very long time. Maybe I should unlearn that now. I should start, like, posting all sorts of controversial stuff, getting those retweets.
Yeah. And again, it's always great to hear about that transparency. I mean, that's what's really made these podcasts such a great thing for the site, is being able to talk to developers like yourself and have these discussions about developing a game, about the design, because these are things that we normally don't hear about, whether due to, like, NDAs and developers, you know, being bound by them, or simply just because there wasn't an outlet to be able to sit down and talk. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we've had some great discussions on these casts. I mean, when we get on a roll, we can talk for like 2-3 hours, like it's nothing on these casts.
Mm-hmm.
And we've done that before, but fortunately I've gotten a little bit better with time management, because I'm sure you don't want to sure you'll be tired by like 2 or 3 hours in, and my voice will be gone too, because I did a bunch of.
We'll just say I'm already tired. I've had some very, very. It's been a long week. Like it's less than a week since we launched. It's been sort of nonstop since then. I think we did get a hot fix out. I was posting the patch notes at like midnight on Saturday. So.
Oh yeah. I can feel about that when posting updates for the site and the video. It can take you into the wee hours of the morning.
Yeah.
All right. Before we wrap up talking about early access, I have just two more questions for you, and then we'll move on to our final section.
Sure. Sounds good.
So the first one is, this is something that I asked both Tim Keenan and Liam Weldon when we talked about their early access experiences with Duskers and Sunless Sea. Well, I'm just curious for you, Forrest, going through the early access process, did you guys run into like any like major debates or things that you discussed with the fans about? Like, I'll give you an example. With Sunless Sea, they had a big discussion and they had to work around when they changed the combat system of the game.
I remember that.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, for you with the Flame of Flood, did you guys have like any like major sit downs or major design decisions that you had to run by or get feedback from your audience from?
No, not really. I mean, there was nothing major, I don't think. Like, there was a lot of difficulty tuning stuff that we did and a lot of like sort of quality of life improvements and whatnot that we did, just in terms of how, you know, you navigated and used the systems and whatnot. But there wasn't, I don't recall there being any like major overhauls or anything. Certainly nothing in the order of the Sunless Sea thing where, you know, they basically like removed, rebuilt in a completely different way a system and then replaced it, which clearly, you know, doing something like that, inevitably you're going to have people that, like, whenever you change anything to that degree, there's going to be some part of the audience, a non-zero number of users who are going to feel that you have made the worst possible decision and everything's ruined and you guys are stupid and doing it all wrong and so on and so forth. Like, there's just no way to to change anything majorly and have everybody be totally happy with it. But also, have you played Sunless Sea before and after that change, they made the right call.
Yeah.
For sure.
Definitely. That's what we talked about on the cast. It just fit the whole game a lot better. And sometimes you do have to, you know, pull that bandage. Especially if you just feel like something's not working, you're just trying to fit a square peg into a round hole.
Yep.
And of course, as you were just saying, Forrest, there's always going to be people who say you've done the worst thing imaginable, you've ruined the game, I'm never going to play your game again.
Yep.
And then you're always going to have people who are going to be like, you did the right thing. And part of being a developer is, you know, figuring out who to listen to and sometimes just going with your gut when making major changes.
Yeah, and just being polite with everybody regardless. Yes.
Definitely.
So that's all you got to do. Like, do what you think is right. Listen to the feedback, and respect and treat well people that, even if they are not liking what you do. I actually think some of the best feedback we get is in the form of when you return a game on Steam, you can leave notes.
Yeah.
About why? Some of that stuff is like unfiltered. It's great because it's just like, wow, okay. You're not trying to be nice at all.
Yes.
But that's good. That's good stuff.
Mm-hmm. So my final question for you regarding early access for us, and this will tie back into Kickstarter, and this is another question that I'm becoming more and more of a standard I like to ask. As someone who has gone through, you know, the whole process, prototype, Kickstarter, early access to release, do you see yourself and Molasses Flood in the future going back to using early access and Kickstarter for whatever your next project is or for future projects?
I mean, actually, honestly, I hope not. Because they've been a really positive experience, but my hope is going forward that we have enough resources that we don't need to do that or go that route. Like, we can, you know, actually conduct play tests to get feedback, and we don't need to, you know, sell people an incomplete game to do it. And also Kickstarter, I think, is changing. Like, if you look at projects on it right now, like Bikes and Knights is looks like it's struggling to fund as I recall. And that game looks amazing. It looks beautiful. It's gorgeous. Their ask is reasonable. You know, the price is reasonable. I think it looks totally on par or better than what, you know, I and the Molasses Flood folks brought to Kickstarter. And it's not funding. So I don't know. I think it depends on what you're doing.
Yeah.
And early access has been generally a very positive experience. However, I'd love to be able to just like get the game really polished and in a good shape without needing to go that route, and just being able to launch on one day and say like, "Hey, everybody, check it out. Complete game. I hope you love it." as opposed to like, "Hey, everybody, check it out. There's a lot of work to do. Help us out." You know?
Yeah.
But you know, not going that route does mean that, you know, we need to hit a certain level of success with this title as well, so that we can like actually afford to just fully develop, start to finish something else. So we'll see.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting is I think you're the first developer I've spoken to so far for us who would prefer to develop a game without using early access and Kickstarter. At least I agree with you completely on Kickstarter. Things have certainly changed. I was looking at the Flame of the Flood. You guys did that campaign in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, between 2012 and 2014, there was already a big change there.
Yep.
And things have certainly been shifted around.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with early access, it's kind of interesting to see different opinions on it. Like, speaking to a lot of developers who've either... Again, there's always that difference between those who've gone from AAA to indie versus those who have started out as indie and pretty much have built up from that way. And a lot of people I've spoken to have pretty much said that they want to just keep using early access. But it's definitely one of the things that different tastes, different preferences for how you want to approach your game development. Because again, every studio has its own style, and there's also the possibility that not every game can really fit on early access. For instance, we've spoken to developers when it comes to like a single player driven game or, you know, a narrative or linear title, early access doesn't work as well compared to like, let's say, a completely open ended sandbox game or something like Duskers or Clockwork Empires.
Yeah, and also I think another issue with early access is that it makes getting people excited about the game when it actually launches, and it makes getting press and stuff like much more challenging. Mm-hmm. Because there's not that much mystery, you know, and I think that's a lot of what drives people to, you know, click on things. Is you need a game that people are excited about, but then there's also needs to be like things that they don't know about it, you know, reasons to actually want to read about it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, once you've been in early access for a while, like the amount of information is almost like perfect, you know?
Yeah.
So it's harder to kind of drum up excitement. And we worked really hard to drum up excitement for us going from early access to launch.
Yeah.
So.
And that is a really great point about that for us, and one that I don't think a lot of people really think about as well. And it's one of the things that we also see with that balancing act of early access, with deciding, you know, how much are you really reveal to the public? Because again, we see some early access where every patch, you know, developer lays all out there, while other ones they may do a lot of internal testing and then release that version of the early access. And as you're saying, building that awareness is certainly a lot harder when you've laid everything out there versus, you know, one day you're not on Steam, next day, you know, our brand new exciting game is here, it's done, you know, come and buy it kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so far, this has definitely been a great cash flow for us, and I feel like we could easily spend next 2-3 hours, but I know it's getting late for me, I'm sure it's getting late for you as well. So we'll move on to our final part for this cast, and that's going to be talking a little bit more about the design of the Flame of the Flood.
Mm-hmm.
We've spoken little bits about over the last 50 minutes or so, but for this final section, we'll talk a little bit more deeply about that. So... for those of you listening to this cast, by the time you hear this, my review should no doubt be up. Be sure to check that out. I'll include a link to that in the podcast notes. And from my experience with the game, I definitely enjoyed it. I do have a few nitpicks to it. I know that before the cast, you had a chance to read my review of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess in terms of playing the game, One of the things that I found interesting, and I know you spoke about this on the Kickstarter itself, was the procedurally generated design of it. The game is procedural by the fact that the river itself is constantly changing, but then you have these hard, or I guess I would say like soft points of interest that these will basically define what you can and can't find in them. Mm-hmm. So like, for instance, the marina is always going to give you the option to upgrade, or the church has a good chance of finding racks and alcohol. As you were coming up with the design of the game, I guess, how did you figure out the progression or the world that you wanted to present to the player?
Well, I knew that in making a river, like one of the sort of the core ideas of the river is that it's this big force that you can't really fight that requires like mutually exclusive decisions along it, you know, and that was sort of where the idea of locations came up, is that I wanted to create a situation where a person through experience learns what they need and then decides like, well, essentially do I, you know, take the left path and hit the church or the right path and hit the camp? So that's kind of where those came from. And then the locations themselves specifically was a mix of figuring out like what the array of items and whatnot that we needed to give the player were going to be, and then mapping those to locations that were iconic or appropriate for the sort of the American South, you know, that we were presenting. So, you know, like there needed to be a church location, for example, and one of the earliest pieces of concept art was of this, you know, Southern roadside gas station. So those two like became right off the bat, like, okay, well, these are locations that we need to have. And then the rest of that got filled in with things like, well, a farm, you know, like a little farm homestead is going to be like a nice fit. And then also fits a need of like, okay, it's a place where you can find like corn and food. So that's sort of where that came from, is I wanted to create a learnable list of specific types of locations that responded or represented specific needs that the player would have, and then they would need to decide what needs were most important as they were traveling, and choose where they stopped accordingly.
Yeah, and earlier in the cast you did talk about trying to base the Flame of the Flood more on realistic survival, so you're not dealing with you know, magical healing spells or fighting the undead or anything like that, but you're dealing with more contemporary or more realistic thing. So, of course, like as the age-old staple from the Oregon Trail, you could get dysentery or infections, lacerations, stuff like that.
Yeah, and, well, you know, we did, like, we do allow ourselves to deviate from hardcore reality at times. But even when we do, it's based on some amount of reality. So, like, one of the goofier, like, crazier things you can make is, like, a smoke bomb.
Oh, yeah.
Which you basically make using at a fire using sumac in a jar. That would not work. But
try this at home, folks.
But you burn sumac, and it does put off a poisonous gas. So at least it's based on that. And, you know, you can cure their snake bites, you know, and you can cure those by drinking dandelion tea, which will not work, obviously. Medical attention. But it is based on sort of traditional medicinal properties of dandelions when brewed into tea. But yeah, those are sort of the goofier ones. But aside from that, everything is pretty based in, let's see, I watched a lot of like YouTube wilderness survival, like how to make a wilderness trap stuff, and also probably my number one reference was a couple wilderness survival guides by this author Tom Brown, where he just talks a lot about like living off various plants and whatnot, like his field guide to medicinal plants is just sat on my desk for the last year and a half or so. And like every plant you can collect is in that book and maps in one way or another to at least one of its functions that he talks about.
Yeah. And it's always funny, like looking at, like talking about that, because I got into watching those survival shows too, like last few years. You mentioned, of course, Les Shroud with Survivor Man, that got me into it. And now we're seeing a lot more of those shows deal with the survival aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a very fascinating feel, especially it's becoming a lot more popular, I think, as a game design setting, whether it is either the more realistic side or the more fantastical side of games like Don't Starve, DayZ, yeah, The Long Dark is another example.
Ark most recently, too. Yeah. Yep.
But yeah, it definitely gives a lot to, it has, like, I think, a lot of elements that make really interesting video games, especially when you get it right and you make, like, a very exciting experience for the player.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the only risk now is, I think there's some risks with it, and one is, like, yeah. I think people are actually getting a bit fatigued by this, and two, like, I think that they can actually be pretty stressful for people in a weird yeah. way that, like, sometimes being shot at is not, just because you need to manage so much stuff, and that I think that that sort of, like, spinning plates approach to survival can kind of stress people out.
Yeah. Now, another part of the Flame of the Flood, dealing with more of the realistic aspects of it, is the, I guess, the quote-unquote enemies of the game. There aren't, like, true enemies in the sense that you're being hunted by, you know, military or other things, but you're dealing with the local wildlife, with the wolves, boar, of course, the grizzly bear. It didn't happen on recording, but I ran into the grizzly bear the other night while I was getting the screenshots for the review. And I mean, it was just one of those perfect moments. It happened during, like, a thunderstorm section, so I couldn't see. And also, I see these, like, giant red eyes coming out of the camera. I go, what could that be? Is it just another wolf?
I'm sure that's fine. And I'm sure it's nothing.
Yeah, I'll just walk up to it. And then I try to hit it with an arrow. I'll just, 1 hour should be enough to kill it. And it just, like, shrugged it off and came running at me like, oh, crap. I think it's time to get back on the raft and go.
Yeah.
Let's just get off here.
Yeah, they're pretty brutal for sure. You got to kind of, if you encounter a bear, you kind of got to back up and, like, make a plan for sure.
Yeah, and that's another part of the game that I really do find fascinating. Again, keeping with this theme of more of a realistic side of survival, you have the different traps set up, snares, and all that, and they all add to these different tools that you have access to, and also makes the hunting side of things a lot different compared to a traditional game.
Mm-hmm.
As you were approaching, I guess, the antagonist side, how did you come up with, like, what the player should be facing and how in the game?
I mean, a lot of that was based on looking at the indigenous wildlife in the American Southeast in particular, and looking at sort of what was the more dangerous things that somebody would need to, and also trying to figure out, like, what was an interesting role that each thing could fulfill. Mm-hmm. And as far as, like, the player's interaction with everything, from, you know, day one, I wanted to, or not exactly day one, but pretty early on, wanted to make a game that wasn't about, like, direct combat, but was much more about, like, sort of dodging and obfuscation and, or, you know, trapping, planning, that kind of thing. So, yeah, the ecology kind of came out of, like, I do lots of little, like, graphs and illustrations of this kind of stuff, and, like, all these things kind of fit together in this graph where you have, like, all the threats down the middle and all the ways to deal with it down one side, and all the ways that all the things that they can do to you down the other, and then all the ways to deal with that further out, and then all these things need to tie back into each other from the same sort of root set of supplies. So it was just, you know, a lot of this came from, like, well, how can we make an interesting ecosystem where everything sort of has a purpose and has an identity and has a function and, you know, forces the player to deal with things in different ways at different times.
Yeah. And one thing that I really do like about the Flame of the Flood compared to other survival games that are more about, I guess, setting up in different locations, again, goes back to the fact that you're on this river, so you're always being pushed forward. There's never, from what I could see, a point where you could, as a player, become self-sustained. Set yourself so you never have to worry about food, or you never have to worry about body temperature, or anything like that.
Yeah, you can hit a point where you don't need to worry about body temperature if you've, like, outfitted yourself fully in bear hides. But that obviously takes a huge amount of resources. Yeah. And a fully upgraded raft can lead to a lot of self-sustainability. But you still need to be getting food along the way.
Yeah.
And so we have had some players do some just incredibly long runs. Mm-hmm. Like there was one guy in our early access who posted screenshots. He had traveled over 600 miles in the game and lived over a year. And it was funny. We posted a video recently of like hunt and gather tips with like, mm-hmm. you know, showing people trapping. Just trapping stuff and whatnot. And he and another experienced player were talking in the forums about how like suboptimal it was what we were illustrating. Because they hit a point where they only, like, he hunts just with snakes. like, he gets wolves and boars and stuff to come after him, but in a way that they get hit by snakes on the way, so it doesn't use up any resources of his. And then once the snake bites these, you know, these animals enough, then they die and he can then harvest them.
Nice.
But yeah, he's, because, like, by, I think, around day 100 or so, like when you're playing in the endless, resources just start diminishing, hazards and wildlife starts increasing. So like by the time he's like at day 200 and certainly 300, there's basically going to be nearly nothing spawning, in terms of like plants that you can use to survive. And there's going to be like just wolves everywhere. But he made it. And I think it probably is impossible to survive indefinitely, because they're also diminishing like stores of like a food decays as well. Unless you like make jerky out of it, which is a trade-off. If you've got meat, you can cook it and it gives you a lot of nutrition, or you can make jerky. It gives you less, uses up salt, but it never spoils.
Yeah.
So I think this guy in his super, super long run basically had just bags full of ash cakes and jerky because they do not spoil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was interesting about the Flame of Love being both, you have this story campaign going through, I think, 10 regions to win, and then you have, of course, the Endless Mode.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to see about how the game evolves when you go beyond that 10-day limit.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was saying in my review, it does leave a lot of room open for continue war, continue expansion, stuff like that. And I know I was reading a forum post earlier that stuff is, you know, you're still thinking about, still too early to tell on those matters.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that is going to actually come down to, like, what we do with the game is going to come down to really a financial question, you know, which is, is it, we've already spent a couple years, basically working on this game, and, is it going to be a smart move for us to keep doing it, or are we just going to be like wasting our time on something that's not gonna, you know, pay off? So if the game, like, essentially what I'm saying is, if the game does all right, we'll keep working on it. If it does poorly, probably not. I mean, obviously we're going to be, we still have Kickstarter stuff, backer stuff to fulfill, and we're obviously working on patches and making sure that everything is like cleaned up and good. But, you know, once we get it to a solid point, if it's not been very successful, then we'll move on to something else. But if it's going great, then yeah, I'd love to keep working on it, keep expanding it, because there's a lot of different ways that we can do it for sure.
Yeah, and one thing that I wanted to talk about, at least with coming up for my review, I also ran into some crashes myself. I think the video that I put up with some beginner tips, actually, it literally ended with the game crashing.
Oh, no.
I think during a thunderstorm, like the whole thing, I got like the weird sound clipping, and then the whole game crash. So it was like the perfect moment. It was like, I guess the game's telling me it's time to wrap the video up.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's, we're super bummed about that, because it wasn't really happening in early access.
Yeah.
I think we know where the crash is happening, and unfortunately it's in the audio library that we're using, which we don't even have source code for. So they're looking at it, but we're trying to figure out, it's really hard, it's a black box that we're trying to figure out, like, what are we feeding it that's causing it to crash?
Yeah.
So we can stop feeding it that, but it's really hard to track down also, because it's not happening on any of our office machines. Like, we saw it once on one, but hadn't been able to reproduce it. We got a patch out on Friday or Saturday night that some users are reporting. It's like fixed, but not everyone. So
yeah,
clearly, we clearly like mitigated a symptom, but didn't actually like cure it. So yeah, we're working hard on that one, and yeah, I'm pretty bummed that that's the case.
Another part, before I talk a little bit more about the design of the Flame of the Fly, I have a few questions there. One thing I definitely want to bring up that I sort of talked about earlier is definitely the art style or the aesthetics of the game, which, as I said, I definitely love that look of it. I guess my question regarding that for you, Forrest, the aesthetics of the game, was that something that was like hard set from day one, or is that something that evolved over the course of development?
So the thing that was set from day one was, you know, in the earliest conversation I had with Scott Sinclair, our art director, the guy responsible for, you know, the essentially making very nearly every model in the game and painting every texture you see, was I came to him and, you know, said basically, hey, Sink, how'd you like to make a game that is your painting and illustration work brought to life? Because he's an accomplished illustrator and a painter, and was also the art director on BioShock and BioShock Infinite. But you know, his own work is sort of has this chunky, angular style, that is more what you see in the game. So like the fact that it was coming from his own personal aesthetic, like that was sort of set from day one. But what that meant, like, really evolved over time as he worked on it. Like, for a while, we were working on it as sort of a 2.5D kind of game, like much like Don't Starve or something like that. But we ended up going full 3D along the way, and yeah, it was also I think when we were initially planning on it, like you can actually see this when there are some screenshots from the game. An article in Game Informer that was like that announced us in the game, and it's actually flat shaded because that's what we were thinking at the time. We were thinking we weren't even using textures, but that changed. So it definitely moved along over time and developed and changed a bit.
And what you have there in the finished product definitely looks amazing. And again, it really does tie into the aesthetics you're going for, with like sort of like this Americana type feel to it. Especially when you get into like some like the later sections and you come to like destroy the little towns and stuff like that. It just has this really great sense of place to it, I think.
Yeah, that was really the work of two people. So Sink was the person who made like the models and the texture work, and then this other guy, Chad LeClair, who is a senior level builder, an environment artist on BioShock Infinite, just built all the various pieces that the engine, like the procedural generation thing, assembles at runtime as we play. But yeah, like all the light work, all the atmospherics, all that stuff is him. Sort of all the in-world composition. Yeah, I'm fortunate to work with some extremely talented artists.
And I guess as a quick aside, it's always fascinating to see these types of very unique and defining aesthetics come from the indie market. Because we see a lot with AAA developers or a lot of AAA games that definitely start to fall, you know, the browns and the grays. You know, the Call of Duty example would be a good one, at least with the older games. And always fascinating when we see indie developers who are able to come with these unique aesthetics. And again, it just really ties into making your game stand out that much more.
Yeah, I mean, I think that also, you know, what is it? I'm totally blanking on the cliche, like necessity is the mother of invention or something like that. Like, we're a small team. We don't have, like, armies of people to throw at normal mapping, you know, thousands of assets. We need to work in a way where we can build a whole game where only one person is making, or one or two people are making the entire world. So you make decisions, and you don't try and fight on the same terms, you know? Like, you don't try and, like, it's a pretty bad idea as a small indie without a lot of resources to essentially try and pick a fight on the same turf as the big AAA thing. So, like, you know, we've got six people on the team in total. It would not make sense for us to do, like, hyper-realistic stuff because we just can't. Like, we just – we could have done one island maybe and no river. If that were the case. So, you know, you just try and differentiate. You try and make something that looks unique and has a voice because you're not going to be able to sort of compete on just spit polish.
Yeah. Getting back to the design, I just have a few more quick questions to wrap things up with because I know we are getting a little bit long.
Sure.
So, one point that I did bring up in my review of The Flame of the Flood is the persistence mechanic with Aesop the dog. Mm-hmm. For those of you listening who haven't played the game yet, when you die in The Flame of the Flood, you basically go back to the beginning of the game. Anything that you have on your friend Aesop in his backpack gets preserved from play after play after play. So it basically lets you sort of a little bit extra. And one thing I was reading some people on the same forum talking about is that it's sometimes with persistent mechanics, it can make it seem like you're not playing for your current run, but you're trying to set up for, like, your future or your best run. Mm-hmm. Some examples, I would say, from, like, the roguelike genre, where you have, like, an optional dungeon or something, but you have to grind the main game in order to get the gear you need to survive for, like those 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
With the Flame of the Flood, where did the decision come from to have, I guess, the persistent mechanic of being able to carry over some elements from your previous play?
Yeah, I thought it would just take, I just wanted to do something small to take a bit of the bite off and also mm-hmm. to give you, because like that sort of the process of dying in the Flame of the Flood is like not necessarily super quick.
Yeah.
Always. So I wanted to create an opportunity for there to be sort of a hurried decision-making process that could occur at those moments.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the idea is like, okay, well now it's time. Like I'm dead. Time to like open up the bag and figure out, all right, what am I going to carry over? What do I need for the next run?
Mm-hmm.
I think to like mitigate sort of playing for the next run is maybe the fact that, the bag only has six slots.
Yeah.
So like there isn't that much. And also, like, the relative value of things. We don't have, like, super items or anything. Like, it's not, mm-hmm. it's not like you can, there's not, like, a rare drop you can find. And, like, eventually you're going to be carrying over, like, all the, like, a full, you know, helm and mm-hmm. you know, plus seven sword of undead smiting or something. You know, like, it's never going to be, like, much better than, like, a bunch of jerky, you know? Mm-hmm.
Or like the tools you need to like immediately craft, like the stone hammer.
Yeah, which is which is a fine tactic for sure. Although maybe you want jars, or maybe you want to bring bandages over. You know, maybe you want to bring some of the stuff that you could have crafted. Maybe you want to throw like a warm jacket on, so you don't need to worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
But because like I think one thing that mitigates the playing for the next run issue is just the fact that like the economy is relatively flat and there's not a lot of things that are like really wildly spike out in terms of they're not like wildly out of whack with the value versus any other thing.
Yeah. And that goes also with the crafting system that a lot of the items by themselves aren't really that valuable. They only become that way when you start combining them for the high level stuff like when you want to get like pouches to increase your inventory space,
mm-hmm.
or if you want to hold on to boar's hides and nuts and bolts for the steel knife upgrade and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I guess my last question regarding game design, then we'll begin to wrap things up. One of the things that at least I found was that the inventory system seemed a little bit clunky to me. I guess coming from Don't Starve, where everything is basically laid out on one screen. So you're not necessarily have to flip between two different screens in order to properly craft things.
Mm-hmm.
It just felt like a little tricky with, like, as managing that and, like, fiddling around with your inventory. Like, I had some case where I had to move something onto Aesop in order to get the space to pick something up to then move that over to Aesop again kind of thing.
Yeah, it's not as slick as I'd like it to be, basically. Like, that was certainly... We have been through so many iterations of the interface, it's better now than it's ever been, but it's still... mm-hmm. We certainly hear loud and clear mm-hmm. in every single review that the interface is a bit clunky, so... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you. I mean, that's certainly one of the things where I don't think, like, I think there are some small things we can do that will help improve it that are certainly doable like, no matter what. I think that that might be one of the things that falls under the, if the game's doing all right and we really want to keep working on it, because I think to like redo that interface into a much smoother system would be, you know, a couple human months of work more, at least. So that'll be one of those things where like, well, if we're finding it's worth it, if it's going to be worth spending the time to invest and keep, if like we think it'll keep, you know, growing and reaching more people and whatnot, that's high on my, like, if we're doing a definitive edition or something like that, that's high on my hit list.
This has definitely been a great cast so far for us, and it's again one becoming one of those casts where we are starting to run a little bit long, so I think it's time to start to wrap things up. And I just have a few general questions left for you, and then we will say goodbye. So, the first one is, we already talked about this earlier regarding future content and future support, but just to reiterate for people listening, at this moment, you guys certainly have plans to do it, but again, that is really going to be based on how well the game does in the market.
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly supporting it afterwards, and bug fixing, you know, making sure that things, that it's in great shape. But yeah, as far as like, you know, doing big amounts of additional content, that sort of thing, that's, right now our plans are, we've got a bunch of Kickstarter specific stuff to take care of. But doing anything beyond that is kind of up in the air and a little too early for us to say right now.
Now, in terms of the platforms, it's obviously currently available on Steam. Are you guys planning on doing like any cross-porting to other platforms?
It's on, let's see, you can get it on Steam, GOG, Humble, Xbox One, and that's it for the moment. We don't have any specific plans for other platforms going forward.
Okay. All right. And I guess one of my last questions then, this is probably too soon to say, but I always like to ask this. Do you guys have any current plans at Molasses Flood for like another project, or is that stuff still way too far in the ether at the moment?
It's way up in the air right now. I'd love to, you know, I'd love there to be another project, but even that, we'll see.
All right. And I guess with that, my final question then for you for this cast for us then is, do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to say to the fans to end the cast on?
Nothing really specific. I just, I mean, I thank you, anybody who's made it through this much of the cast and is still, still listening to me. And thanks to everybody who's checked the game out. And, thank you for taking the time to play it and have me on and, you know, writing up a thoughtful review. I very much appreciate it.
All right. Not a problem. And I would definitely like to do more playing with the Flame of the Flood. I think what I may try to do at some point, maybe just do a complete campaign run just to show off, you know, the 10-day or the 10-region survival mode.
Awesome. Yeah,
I definitely enjoy the game. As I said, I really like games that go for, like, a unified aesthetic and design. And the Flame of the Flood definitely has that. I mean, even with, like, the soundtrack, I'm not a huge fan of country, but, again, it fits with this game, and it just adds to the overall, I guess, design and presentation of it.
Yeah, it's we lucked out working with Chuck for the soundtrack, for sure.
Awesome. All right. So with that said, we are going to wrap things up for the cast tonight. Forrest, it's been a pleasure talking with you. For those of you listening to the cast, we are recording this. I think it's been just about a week since the game's been released. So in case I don't talk to you in the future, definitely good luck with getting the future support for the Flame of the Flood and for whatever your next project may be.
Great, thank you so much.
Not a problem. So for those of you listening to the cast, thanks a lot for tuning in. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom and check us out, there are several options available. First, for our ongoing Patreon campaign to secure much-needed monthly funding, you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom, and you can also check that little Patreon banner at the top of the front page. Any donations will be greatly appreciated there. If you'd like to be a guest host or... a guest writer or a guest on the podcast, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. And, of course, be sure to check me out both on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer. That way you will always be alerted to whenever I make new posts, start my streams, any useful information like that. And last but not least, there is, of course, the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, where videos such as my Spotlight and Beginner's Guide to the Flame of the Flood is currently available. You can find that out by clicking the little YouTube link on the front page, or by just searching for Game Wisdom. So again, thanks so much for tuning in to this episode. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.